Hello, and welcome to The Learning College, put on by Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and this and everything we record can be found at vnnforum.com and permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume with Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland, published in 2017. If you go to Merchants of Sin, hyphenated those three words, .com, you can order the book yourself. It has a lot of footnotes. A lot of graphics. Today we're going to do part 7 of Merchants of Sin called Second Wave Feminism. And that'll take us from page 101 to 124. So let's dig into it. Part 7, Second Wave Feminism. Epigraph. As activists, professionals, artists, and intellectuals, Jewish feminists have shaped every aspect of American life. From the Jewish Women's Archive. The foundational text of what became known as Second Wave Feminism was The Second Sex, which was written by the French woman Simone de Beauvoir in 1948 and published in English in 1953. The first wave of feminism had dissipated after the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in 1920. So second wave feminism begins with The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir in 1948 or around the mid-century point, published in French and English. Beauvoir was not a Jew, but one wonders how much of her ideas were influenced by her Jewish lover, Nelson Algren, the one who, quote, advised her to write the book, as it says in the introduction, and her other longtime lover, the abusive Marxist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre, though also not a Jew, practically worshipped them. He authored what has to be one of the most philo-Semitic tracts of all time, The Anti-Semite and the Jew. The book takes as its premise the Freudian concept that anti-Semites are just projecting their own shortcomings onto Jews. Quote, if the Jew did not exist, the anti-Semite would invent him. And ends with the outrageous declaration that, quote, not one Frenchman will be secure so long as a single Jew, in France or in the world at large, can fear for his life. So you notice how the Jews use and promote goy who serve their cause, like Kinsey and his bogus sex statistics we heard about in an earlier session. Here it's a Marxist philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre, and feminist Simone de Beauvoir. And then there's a big graphic, Sartre, anti-Semite and Jew. And he's kind of a wall-eyed, fish-lip motherfucker. Jean-Paul Sartre's brilliant, scathing portrait of prejudice and anti-Semitism. Liver-lipped, wall-eyed bastard. Sartre even dropped his previous philosophical worldview and instead found solace in Messianic Judaism during the final months of his life. Underlying Beauvoir's The Second Sex, and therefore all of Second Wave Feminism, are the Jewish ideologies of Marxism and Freudianism, which we heard about united last time by Wilhelm Reich to promote the sexual revolution. Beauvoir was an egalitarian absolutist, a blank slatist, and thus she denied human nature and gender differences in their entirety. According to her, all feminine personality traits have been imposed on women from the outside, by society, by the patriarchy. One is not born, but rather becomes woman, she wrote, famously. I gave that a bit of a Russian accent, but it should be French. One is not born, but rather becomes a woman, she wrote. Becomes woman, no article. So women are a creature of, they're socially constructed, like race. Sex and race are socially constructed. Well, she's the one, the sort of first second wave feminist, the mainspring, her book, The Second Sex. And a big picture of her, not an unattractive woman. Again, she's not a Jew. The only reason women hold what in Beauvoir's estimation is an inferior role in society and history is because men have actively held them back. exact opposite of the truth. In this, she declared women's solidarity with blacks and Jews as mutually oppressed victims of cultural and social conditioning by white, heterosexual males. And you see how this repugnant, anti-factual political position has matured over the second half of the 20th century and nearly 20 years into the 21st. Beauvoir claimed that, quote, no maternal instincts exist, and that marriage is domestic slavery. The only way for a woman to establish her existence, she argued, is to get out of the home and get a career. Children must be taken care of by the state. So that's pretty much the pure communist point of view, and get your career established before you have any children point of view that's common among the bourgeois in America in 2017. Housewives, Beauvoir stated repeatedly, are, quote, parasitic. True equality, in her view, would only be reached when, quote, both sexes have equal legal rights and the whole of the feminine sex enters public industry. The second sex betrays an inferiority complex in Beauvoir and is written in a way that almost seems calculated to instill one into its women readers, that women are inferior and they're only useful if they're imitating men, and only valid if they're trying to become amateur men. This is constant with all feminist philosophy, and therein lies the danger. By denying women's natural and sacred role of mother and caregiver, and instead professing they are equal to men, the feminist philosophy inevitably invokes in women envy about their historic and current inferior role in the realm of male activities. This in turn leads to feelings of frustration, anger, and hatred toward men, as well as a totalitarian impulse to impose their will in society using pro-feminist laws and policies backed by the power of the state. This feminist totalitarian impulse was readily observable in Beauvoir. In a discussion with Jewish feminist Betty Friedan, and Betty Friedan, a Jew, who is discussed further below, which was published in the Saturday Review, in a discussion with her between Beauvoir and Friedan, Beauvoir stated that she believed that, quote, no woman should be authorized to stay at home to raise her children, that society should actually force them to get a career instead, quote, because if there is such a choice, too many women will decide to stay home. In my opinion, she goes on to say, as long as the family and the myth of the family and the myth of maternity and the maternal instinct are not destroyed, women will still be oppressed. Beauvoir also argued that in order for men and women to be truly equal, women must be able to engage in casual sex without suffering any negative consequences. The prerequisites for this are safety, i.e. the force of the state to compensate for physical inferiority, the removal of the social stigma placed upon women who surrender their chastity early, e.g. campaigns against slut-shaming we'd know them as today, and the removal of the fear of pregnancy, i.e. birth control and abortion on demand. The sex-obsessed early feminist Margaret Sanger, whose surname came from a Jewish husband, she was not a Jew herself, campaigned for a pill that would block pregnancy for many decades, believing as far back as 1912 that it would be the only way to properly, quote, emancipate women. We move on to 105, and there's a picture of a slut walk from 2012, and actually those are some of the better. They're wearing at least bras and shorts, unlike some of the other slut walks, and they're actually better looking than the vast majority of slut walkers I've seen. In 1951, Sanger commissioned the Jewish scientist Gregory Pincus, that's a Jew name, to work on developing such a pill. Though this endeavor was still far from being socially acceptable to the wider public, Pincus had no reservations about how society would view him, and he had nothing to lose. At the time, he was struggling financially and professionally, and he had been dismissed from his position at Harvard years earlier after receiving widespread condemnation in the press, which characterized him as a mad scientist straight from the pages of Brave New World for his experiments in trying to harvest rabbit eggs in test tubes. Gregory Pincus, developing a birth control pill funded by Margaret Sanger, or backed by him. Pincus chose as his partner in developing the pill a Catholic dissident with homosexual tendencies named John Rock. He passed over his first two choices, Abraham Stone and Alan Guttmacher, because they were also both Jews, and Pincus didn't want to invite criticism against Jews. Pincus, Rock, and Sanger, supported financially by the wealthy widowed Protestant feminist Kathy McCormick, succeeded in developing their pill by the end of the 50s, and by the 60s it was being distributed to millions of American women. The pill was a necessary prerequisite for second-wave feminism, as well as the broader sexual revolution, which had been brewing under the surface of American life for some time, as it allowed women to engage in casual sex without the fear of pregnancy, and/or pursue a career without having unwanted children to care for. There's a big picture of a smiling, heavily bag-eyed Dr. Gregory Pincus. In 1963, Betty Friedan, née Goldstein, a closet Marxist, took the nation by storm when she published The Feminine Mystique, which quickly became a bestseller. So in the early 50s, you have her Feminine Mystique and The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, both coming out in English in America. The main thrust of The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan was that being a housewife is an intolerably miserable existence. But now when they do polls, they find that most women wish they could be housewives instead of the very hard jobs they have to endure and not having husbands. So the sexual revolution might have been good for corporations, might have been good for the government, but it's been very bad for women and families. Thus, it could hardly avoid being bad for men, too. But this is the start of the lie. Women are really only valid if they're men, says the second sex, and women who are housewives are extremely miserable. Both complete Marxist Jewish lies. She backed up this theory almost entirely with anecdotal evidence from alleged interviews she had conducted with everyday women. So just as you have Kinsey lying about everyday average American sexual behavior, you have this Jew, Friedan, lying about ordinary everyday housewife feelings and activities. Well, what do you know? He makes that exact point. She backed up this theory, Friedan did, almost entirely with anecdotal evidence from alleged interviews she had conducted with everyday women and the fraudulent data of Alfred Kinsey's sexual behavior in the human female, which claimed that a shockingly high amount of women were already, in the 1950s, having premarital and extramarital sex and abortions. See Part 5 for more on Kinsey. We've already covered that. And we know that the main fellow who pushed abortion was a Bernard Nathanson, a Jew, deliberately lied about the number of back alley abortions, as they like to call it, in order to get their law passed, or the Roe versus Wade that they did eventually get from the Supreme Court. So Jews have no trouble falsifying, using fake science, using science as a cover for their politics. That's one of the main things that you should learn as we do these. Just because someone claims something is science doesn't mean that it actually is. Science is a very convenient drag, cover story, or pretext for pushing some kind of white destructive politics. You should know that. Friedan claimed that she had been unable to find even one single housewife out of the hundreds, or maybe even thousands, that she had interviewed who was happy with their life. This was a bald-faced lie, as examples of women who legitimately enjoyed being housewives were easily found in great numbers back then. It was not the only time that Friedan would deliberately portray a minority opinion as a majority one in order to sell it to the public, as we'll see below. Yeah, that's a standard Jewish trick, claiming to speak for the public, to speak for the community. That's not who we are, says the 2% Jew to the 98% white majority. There's a picture of Betty Friedan, who is a classic, ugly Jewess. with almost like a boxer's nose rather than a hook nose and liver lip, fish lipped, unattractive eyes, downward tilted. Physical ugliness that goes with intellectual dishonesty. So the brain behind the outer shell and facade is just as ugly as the thing it's cased in. She quotes an anonymous doctor as allegedly saying, "You'd be surprised at the number of these happy suburban wives who simply go berserk one night and run shrieking through the street without any clothes on." Complete bullshit. Again, we must be mindful of the suggestibility of women. All humans are impressionable to some degree, with women much more so than men. By putting out ideas such as these, feminists plant the seeds of doubt and suspicion in the minds of women, who would otherwise be happy. Doubts about their own happiness and position in life, suspicion toward their own husbands and men in general, the very ones who care for them. Like Beauvoir, Friedan argued that a housewife is a parasite, direct quote, parasite, and that a woman needs to get her career in order to be fulfilled. In the chapter Seeking Sex, she claimed that most housewives were sexually unsatisfied with their husbands and thus either fantasized about or were already having affairs. Most controversially, Friedan compared the lives of American housewives to that of Nazi concentration camp inmates. She draws this parallel using the 1960 Holocaust horror fantasy book, The Informed Heart, which was written by a Jewish psychoanalyst named Bruno Bettelheim. Bettelheim claimed that the systematic dehumanization on the part of Nazi guards gradually turned the Jewish inmates into virtual children, who, along with becoming, quote, inordinately interested in defecation and urination, came to sympathize with their sadistic torturers to the point of eventually obediently marching to their deaths. In the chapter, quote, Progressive Dehumanization, The Comfortable Concentration Camp, which is what Friedan called the home, she wrote, quote, "The women who grow up wanting to be just a housewife are in as much danger as the millions who walk to their own deaths in concentration camps. By adjusting to the home, a woman stunts her intelligence to become childlike, turns away from individual identity to become an anonymous biological robot in a docile mass. She becomes less than human. All men, according to this logic, are comparable to sadistic SS guards if they have a wife who is at home raising children instead of out pursuing a career. A pretty extreme claim, to say the least." Friedan's black propaganda was internalized by countless women. Quote, "Her book awakened hundreds of thousands, if not millions of women, to what they had long felt but been unable to articulate. The way the mystique of suburban womanhood smothered aspirations for a more fulfilling life," wrote Jewish author Daniel Horowitz. Male. The publication of The Feminine Mystique is widely considered to be the official launch point of second-wave feminism, and Friedan became its de facto leader and spokeswoman. In 1966, Friedan became the first president of the National Organization of Women, which she had co-founded along with 48 other feminists. 1966. Now is formed. In 1970, she organized a Women's Strike for Equality. The idea behind this event, which took place on the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, was for women to go on, quote, strike nationwide by ceasing to cook or clean for their husbands. She also arranged for there to be marches. Tens of thousands of women took to the streets all across America, as many as 50,000 in New York alone, calling for state-sponsored 24/7 daycare centers, legal abortion on demand, and equality in the workplace and education system. The women carried banners with slogans such as, "Don't iron while the strike is hot," "Don't cook dinner, starve a rat today," and the overtly Marxist, "Women of the World Unite," a play on the communist cry derived from the Communist Manifesto, "Workers of the World Unite." Of the five main speakers at the Women's Strike for Equality, four were Jews: Betty Friedan, Bella Abzug, Gloria Steinem, and Bess Meyerson, and only one was a Gentile, Kate Millett. Flipping to 110, picture of some of these signs. Don't cook dinner, starve a rat today. I mean, Christ on a crutch. Housewives are unpaid slaves. End human sacrifice. Don't get married. Washing diapers is not fulfilling are on their signs. Many feminists didn't think Now went far enough, so they formed the New York Radical Women, NYRW, in 1967. Not content with merely marching and picketing, these women, the precursor of modern-day Femen and Pussy Riot, staged outrageous and over-the-top stunts, disruptions, and protests all across the nation. When 5,000 feminists showed up in the Capitol to protest Vietnam with a Women's Strike for Peace, for example, the New York Radical Women crashed it with placards reading, "The Death of Traditional Womanhood," and "Don't Cry, Resist." Later, they crashed the after party carrying a coffin and then symbolically buried it in a mock ritual. In 1969, the NYRW staged a protest at the annual Miss America pageant. Spearheaded by the hate-filled Jewess Robin Morgan, this stunt became one of the most famous and widely publicized of all feminist activities. The basis of their protest was the idea that Miss America objectifies women. Quote, "the degrading, mindless, boob-girly symbol," as Morgan wrote in the protest official pamphlet. There, they handed out flyers, held up placards, mockingly crowned a sheep, and threw feminine beauty products such as makeup, eyeliner, and high-heel shoes into a, quote, "freedom trash can." And there's a big picture of same. And large open-mouthed women who were still skinny at that time. These feminists were skinny. Today they'd be obese because the average woman weighed like 135 back then. And the average man weighed 165, 30 pounds more. But today both sexes weigh 30 pounds more on average. So these were still skinny, even attractive women, these feminists. Whereas, as I say, today at the best they'd be fat and most would be obese. Caption on the pictures shows them throwing stuff into the freedom trash can. The Miss America protest is where the term bra burners originated. The Miss America protest. Though it is inaccurate, as the feminists weren't permitted to burn anything as they had originally planned. The NYRW, New York Radical Women, splintered in 1969. Some of them, such as Morgan, went on to form the group Witch, and others went on to form the Red Stockings. Which stood for the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, protested a bridal fair at the Madison Square Garden. Dressed in all black, they taunted the brides by singing, "Here comes the slaves, off to their graves," and then released white mice into the stadium. The other splinter group, the Red Stockings, was founded by two Jewesses, Shulamith Firestone, born Shulamith Bath Shmuel Ben Ari Feuerstein, and Ellen Willis. Their manifesto read in part, the Red Stockings, "Women are an oppressed class. Our oppression is total, affecting every facet of our lives. We are exploited as sex objects, breeders, domestic servants, and cheap labor. We are considered inferior beings whose only purpose is to enhance men's lives. Our humanity is denied. Our prescribed behavior is enforced by the threat of physical violence." And again, there's a picture right below that of Witch, the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. And honestly, like I said, they're not bad-looking women. Today, they would all be 220-plus pounds. So the patriarchy, if it existed and if it did nothing else, kept these women nice and slim and sexy, even the very worst of them, the New York feminists. Just saying. Good solid sixes and sevens, even the most radical back then. "All men have oppressed women," they concluded, categorically. Later in that same year, 1969, the volatile Firestone split from the Red Stockings and co-founded the New York Radical Feminist, NYRF, with Anna Coate, K-O-E-D-T, author of the influential screed, The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm. Because if you don't have a vaginal orgasm, then a penis is irrelevant. You just need a finger or something else to stimulate the clitoris. So yeah, the personal is political. The genitalia are political. With the NYRF, they staged many meaningful and thoughtful protests, such as the one against the sex role stereotyping of Christmas toys. And that battle still goes on today across all toys, so they want to get rid of the distinction between girls' and boys' toys, and they celebrate whenever a retailer gets rid of those categories, lumps them into one. In 1970, Firestone published her book, The Dialectic of Sex, The Case for a Feminist Revolution, which is considered one of the classic and foundational texts of radical feminism. The book, which would go on to be an international bestseller, is an unholy mix of Marx, Freud, Marcuse, see Part 5, and Reich, Wilhelm Reich, see Part 6, and Beauvoir, whom it is dedicated to. It reads like the mad ravings of a supervillain in a bad science fiction novel, revealing the diabolical plan for a dystopian future. Whereas in traditional Marxist theory, inequality stems from economic class division, the exploitation of the worker by the capitalist, Firestone argued that what inequality truly stems from is sex class division. So Marx set up a pattern, but it's one that can easily be swapped out for others. Instead of the bourgeois being bad, it can be all men being bad, it can be all white men being bad. But the idea of classes not working together are not natural divisions among people that are nevertheless complementary. In Marx's theory, they're always at odds and they're always battling for power. Proles and bourgeois, whites and blacks, etc., etc. So Marx set up a pattern that you can do Goldberg variations on, so to speak. Sex class division, Firestone acknowledged, is born from biological realities. Most of women's energy has always had to go toward rearing children, making them dependent on males for survival. And of course, only women have the responsibility of getting pregnant and birthing children, which Firestone asserted is barbaric, like, quote, shitting a pumpkin. Now that male-invented technology was reaching a level where women could theoretically be freed from these biologic and reproductive inequalities, quote, humanity has begun to outgrow nature, Firestone was proposing a revolution after which artificial forms of reproduction would be normalized. Quote, children would be born to both sexes equally, or independently of either, however one chooses to look at it. After the revolution, quote, the tyranny of the biological family would be broken, and humankind would become entirely androgynous. Quote, the end goal of feminist revolution must be not just the elimination of male privilege, but of the sex distinction itself. Genital differences between human beings would no longer matter culturally. And there's a chart in the Dialectic of Sex. The caption reads, as we see in this arbitrary chart in the Dialectic of Sex, patriarchy is alleged to have begun with pair marriage. Therefore, reaching equality, i.e. communism, requires the abolition of marriage, the destruction of the family. They show savagery, barbarism, civilization, aristocracy, and lower class, aristocracy, bourgeois, proletariat, and then in the future, recorded history, Greece, Renaissance, modern revolution. After the modern revolution, you'll have communism and socialism, and everybody will be equal, and everybody will be happy. It's completely absurd. Cartoonishly, Firestone proposed that women would carry out this presumably violent revolution all by themselves. Men, she conceded, would have no motive to assist them and thus give up their dominant role in society. Quote, to assure the elimination of sexual classes requires the revolt of the underclass, women, and the seizure of control of reproduction, not only the full restoration to women of ownership of their own bodies, but also their temporary seizure of control of human fertility, the new population biology, as well as all the social institutions of childbearing and child-rearing. Garland again, could you imagine women plotting a revolt and physically seizing control of anything from men? How were Shulamith and her acolytes supposed to pull this off? This is never explained, nor is it remotely plausible. It's just abstract, maniacal ramblings. The Dialectic of Sex, which, again, is considered a classic and foundational text of second-wave feminism, should be all the proof needed that Firestone was fit for a straitjacket. But just to be sure, it's a matter of public record that shortly after it was published, she descended into full-blown paranoid schizophrenia. Remember, Jews like her have a higher rate of mental warping, mental problems, than Goy. In 2012, Firestone died in obscurity in her apartment while receiving government assistance. Her rotting corpse lay there for about a week, until the neighbors finally complained about the odor to the building's superintendent. She is still considered a feminist icon, nonetheless. She had those circular John Lennon glasses and long hair, that classic 60s, early 70s feminist, even just female look. Picture of her on the bottom of 115, Shulamith Firestone. Flipping over to 116, Firestone's writings, while being some of the more radical, were in many ways perfectly in line with mainline feminist thinking. One of their mantras has always been the Margaret Sanger-inspired, quote, "Women should have control over their own bodies." In other words, it isn't fair that women should have to bear children and not men, so this inequality, this burden, must somehow be overcome. One of the largest feminist victories in this regard was the legalization of abortion, which they had agitated for from the very beginning. Betty Friedan was one of the founders, along with two other Jews, Bernard Nathanson and Lawrence Leder, of the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, NARAL, N-A-R-A-L. You'll see it at any abortion rally, which was the foremost organization that pushed for abortion in the late 60s and early 70s. Again, they got Roe v. Wade in 73. With NARAL, these Jews, evidently well-versed in human psychology, purposely used deceit to achieve their nefarious aims, as was revealed by Nathanson years later when he had a change of heart and became against abortion, even though he was the main one who pushed for it back then. Ladder, L-A-D-E-R, another Jew, Ladder and I were perfect for each other, he told a conservative journalist, David Kupelian, in a 2005 interview. We sat down and plotted out the organization now known as NARAL. With Betty Friedan, we set up this organization and began working on the strategy, and they can do this because all the Jews in the media are leftist, and the non-Jews are leftist too, and they will support any kind of leftist movement, any kind of feminism. Quote, we persuaded the media that the cause of permissive abortion was a liberal, enlightened, sophisticated one, he continued. Quote, knowing that if a true poll were taken, we would be soundly defeated, we simply fabricated the results of fictional polls. We announced to the media that we had taken polls and that 60% of Americans were in favor of permissive abortion. This is the tactic of the self-fulfilling lie, a very common tactic across all Judeo-leftist politics, the self-fulfilling lie. Few people care to be in the minority. We aroused enough sympathy to sell our program of permissive abortion by fabricating the number of illegal abortions done annually in the U.S., the actual figure was approaching 100,000, but the figure we gave to the media repeatedly was 1 million. So they exaggerated by 10 times the amount of back alley abortions going on. They deliberately lied about polls and backdoor abortion, back alley abortions in order to create a self-fulfilling lie so that people would believe them, just the way Kinsey did and his promoters did. Repeating, still in the quote, repeating the big lie often enough convinces the public. The number of women dying from illegal abortions was around 200 to 250 annually. The figure we constantly fed to the media was 10,000, so not even 10. They're going, you know, 50 times at that point. Exaggerated by 50 times. Similar to what they do with hate crimes, they make a tiny portion of allegedly political crimes committed by whites outweigh the vast majority of crimes committed by non-whites. Lying, always lying, the people of the lie, is the best, fairest, most accurate way to characterize Jews. So again, the number of women dying from illegal abortions was around 200 to 250 annually. The figure we constantly fed to the media was 10,000. These false figures took root in the consciousness of Americans, convincing many that we needed to crack the abortion law. Another myth we fed to the public through the media was that legalizing abortion would only mean that the abortions taking place illegally would then be done legally. In fact, of course, abortion is now being used as a primary method of birth control in the U.S., and the annual number of abortions has increased by 1,500% since legalization. There's a picture of Nathanson, Opgyn, former abortionist. He later, as I said, he flipped and became anti-abortion. The Jewish feminist Heather Booth organized the Abortion Counseling Service of the Women's Liberation, Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation, better known by its codename Jane, in 1968. They performed illegal underground abortions for thousands of women in two Chicago apartments until the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalized it nationwide. Jane, or the Jane Collective, was the go-to place for illegal abortions. They were only raided once. Seven abortionists were arrested, but the charges were dropped after Roe. On the Jewish Women's Archive website, Booth claims that her motivation for performing illegal abortions was Tikkun Olam, which translates to English as repairing the world. A picture of Heather Booth, another repugnant, ugly Jewess. Heather Booth claims she was repairing the world by illegally murdering unborn babies. In practice, it would be more apt to look at Tikkun Olam as Orwellian Yiddish code for destroying the world. Just about every destructive policy the Jews push is excused by this Tikkun Olam, T-I-K-K-U-N, new word O-L-A-M, Tikkun Olam. Fixing the world, gathering up the shards of the shattered mirror and putting them together to form, you know, the reform the bowl or whatever it was originally. And that each Jew gathering a shard of goodness is doing his tikkun olam. It's complete garbage. Whether it be opening the borders for mass immigration, LGBT rights, forced racial integration, or, as in this case, murdering unborn babies in order to, quote, liberate women from having to take responsibility for their actions. Even outright communism can fall under the banner of Tikkun Olam. Beginning in the early 70s, the Jewess Gloria Steinem became the public face of feminism. So from Beauvoir in France, and then in the Anglophone countries, Beauvoir, and then to Friedan in the early 50s, and we go to Jewess Gloria Steinem, former Playboy bunny in the early 70s, the public face. This was due, says Garland, largely to her striking good looks, which is an uncommon feature among Jewesses in general, and among feminists in particular. So she's wildly unrepresentative of Jews, feminist, or either of those groups. And there's a picture of Gloria Steinem. And as I said, she was a Playboy bunny, and she was good looking much of her life. Steinem had first garnered recognition in 1963 after she posed as a Playboy bunny for an investigative journalism piece for Show magazine, A Bunny's Tale. In 1968, she became radicalized by attending a Red Stockings meeting. In 1972, she founded her own magazine, Ms., and put in its inaugural issue a list of 53 prominent women who were proudly coming out to say they had had abortions. Within 5 years, Ms. Magazine had a circulation of 500,000. Susan Brown Miller, another very prominent Jewish feminist, wrote in her memoir, In Our Time, quote, saying, I've had three illegal abortions allowed was my feminist baptism, my swift immersion in the power of sisterhood, such is the disturbing mindset of a feminist. Brown Miller's main claim to fame was her 1975 book on rape, Against Our Will, in which she wrote that rape is, quote, nothing more or less than a conscious process of intimidation by which all men keep all women in a state of fear. There's a picture of Susan Brown Miller. Average looking sort of broad, I'd say. Along with legalized abortion on demand and other insolent feminist demands, gender equality, in quotes, to them meant that women must be allowed to have sex with as many people as they want without facing any consequences. As such, the feminists were 100% in favor of the sexual revolution from day one. Behaving like a raging slut was quite literally, in their minds, an act of, quote, liberation. In 1973, the Jewish feminist Erika Jong wrote the book Fear of Flying, which has sold an astonishing 27 million copies worldwide. Erika Jong, Fear of Flying, Jew. In Fear of Flying, Jong encourages women to cheat on their husbands. She tells them that sex with their husbands is inevitably boring, and so they should be on the search for real excitement in no-strings-attached sex with complete strangers. The zipless fuck, she calls it. Famous term. The book includes such flowery language as, quote, you long to be annihilated by love, to be swept off your feet, to be filled up by a giant prick spouting sperm, soap suds, silks, and satins, and of course, money. John goes on at length in the book about her fascination with toilets and feces. She just couldn't get toilets off her mind, she explains. In fact, she did so much, quote, thinking about toilets while in Europe that she once wrote a history of the world through toilets, which she kindly shares with the reader in all its disgusting detail. Here's a picture of Erika Jong, who's kind of a more Germanic-looking Jewess, a heavier nose and heavier chin, and not bad-looking, not really good-looking either. This bizarre, a more Aryan-looking Jew than some of these other ones, straight nose, not a hook nose. This bizarre fascination with feces is a characteristic that is frighteningly common among Jews. It can find no more prominent example than yet another Jewish feminist leader, the obese lesbian Andrea Dworkin. In her writings, Dworkin psychoanalyzed sexual acts in the most filthy and fecal-centric ways one could ever imagine, of which the following is just a small sample. Quote, in other words, the vagina is dirty like the rectum. The penis evokes the turd in the rectum because the man has the experience of touching a membrane just like the rectal wall. The relationship of the penis to the actual turd is evocative and symbolic, distant. For humans, the descent into the excremental is a descent into sadism and death. For women, being excremental is the dimension of inferiority that legitimates and makes appropriate sadistic sexual acts that pass as simple sex. A cruelty in sex, the brutal domination through sexual subjugation of a worthless, essentially scatological thing. And, well, we'll get there. Dworkin, who, like Firestone before her, called for the end of the incest taboo through, quote, destruction of the nuclear family, was not a fringe figure in the feminist movement by any means, despite her unbelievably grotesque and hateful rhetoric. Even Florence King, who I admire, praised her as a genuine intellectual. Not that she agreed with her on stuff, but she was more seriously intellectual than most of these women we've been talking about. Rather, she was a broadly recognized leader and theorist. What these mentally insane Jewish feminists have pushed on our women is absolutely shocking and breathtaking. Studying the topic at length has been pretty surreal, says Garland. As the above passage indicates, there appears to be no end to the depths of their depravity. In conclusion, I will let Dworkin herself spell out the true aims of the feminist movement so as to avoid any confusion. In her 1974 book, Women Hating, hyphenated, again, a classic and a foundational feminist text, not an obscure or a fringe one, the Jewess Dworkin wrote, quote, we want to destroy sexism, that is, polar role definitions of male and female, man and woman. We want to destroy patriarchal power at its source, the family, in its most hideous form, the nation state. We want to destroy the structure of culture as we know it, its art, its churches, its laws, all of the images, institutions, and structural mental sets which define women as hot, wet fuck tubes, hot slits. And there's below that, to close out page 123, a big picture of Andrea Dworkin. And it does take a big picture to hold all of that mountain of Jewish feminist. She's got New Balance shoes on. She's got overalls that have cut off bottoms, black socks into her New Balance. And she's got her hands, elbows akimbo on her massive protruding hip rump and gigantic tits, Venus of Willendorf style. She's just ugly and has frizzy hair on top of that and is wearing like a plaid vest over a t-shirt under her overalls. Not a prepossessing woman. Although not without genuine intelligence, but a completely 100% destructive force. So we flip onto the final page of this session, 124. Just to reiterate, in case you didn't catch that, feminists want to destroy gender roles, the family, the nation, culture, art, religion, law, all institutions. This is nice. In short, they want to destroy all of Western civilization, which is indeed synonymous with patriarchy. And they've gone a long way toward doing just that. Still growing strong, feminism is now in its so-called third wave, with radical Jews still making up a disproportionate amount of its leadership and theorists. Beginning in the early 1960s, when they first got going, the feminists have scored victory after victory in the legal system, the detrimental effects of which would take many volumes to even begin discussing. Feminism has proved itself to be quite a formidable existential threat. If the damage that it has wrought is not reversed in its entirety, with a very firm hand, our civilization will soon be gone forever. In Part 8, we will look at how Jews have been using film as a weapon of moral subversion, and then we will conclude our series with Part 9, where we look at the Jewish control of hardcore pornography. So that was kind of the story of second wave feminism. And really an excellent sort of summary of the main figures, their books, and their intentions, so that all you need to understand is that they are out to destroy you and your kind. Well, I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you real soon, and we'll do more from The Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland.